in terms of looking at kind of a timeline and, you know, who developed what when, we have not done that. I would like to do that. Unfortunately, 200 patients scattered across a whole century almost did not make it possible. We do have, since this data has been analyzed, another 530 questionnaires, which I've had a chance to look at only in a preliminary fashion. The one thing that has been reassuring is that the distribution and the characteristics of the respondents is quite similar. So what we're hoping to do is pool this and hopefully with kind of larger numbers get have an opportunity to do some cluster analysis and answer the kind of question you raised.
I have to make a comment about spinal muscular atrophy. I tend to disagree with the comments that spinal muscular atrophy has upper motor neuron signs. The true spinal muscular atrophy does not have upper motor neuron signs by definition. We have seen that in AIDS, at least during the last decade, the hundreds of patients with spinal muscular atrophy, the Kupffer-Wolander type, and they do not clinically at least have upper motor neuron signs. As far as the upper motor neuron signs in patients with old polio, in our patients of at least 30 patients that we have followed and examined clinically, none of them had or developed during the 5 years periods of observation upper motor neuron signs. In addition, we have done PET scans in our patients to look for of the brain to see whether there is decreased metabolism of the upper motor neurons in the brain, particularly in the motor cortex, and we did not find any evidence of hypometabolism in the motor cortex, whereas we found hypometabolism in ALS patients.
I have a vague recollection of a paper published by Dr. Ginsberg from New York in my journal about giant sensory potentials. He found that in old polio, the sensory potential may reach the amplitude over 100 microvolts. And to my knowledge, this has not yet been explained. I wonder whether anybody else had this kind of information.
I'm not going to try to answer that. I know that Dick Bruno cited that in his reference list for the abstract. Maybe wasn't it you, Dick? So he'll be talking about that later.
What I was talking about with the ALS syndrome is that it is truly a continuum. I certainly agree, and I would not include Kugelberg-Wielander in that, but in the adult form of progressive spinal muscular atrophy, even though you cannot get evidence of upper motor neuron signs clinically, you will get an H reflex in the upper motor upper extremity nerves, which tells me that it is truly a continuum rather than a dichotomous separation. I'd also like to make the point about the respiratory problems. We reviewed 12 cases back in 1974 of post-polio people who were in a ventilator originally and then 25 or 30 years later required it again. And it wasn't, we have one case that had a sleep apnea obstructive, but most of the cases were clearly a reduction in the pulmonary thoracic compliance that occurred as a result of the aging process, if you want to look at it that way. That is, they became unable to exchange the same volume of air with nothing or with their chest shell and had to go to a more significant respiratory aid.
Last question and then coffee break.
Could I just show one of your slides again, Laurel?
Yes, which one? With the hospitalized, non-hospitalized group?
Pardon me?
Hospitalized, non-hospitalized group?
Well, I think this one brings out the point that I want to make. I think what you're saying here is that there is no doubt an increased incidence of difficulties with aging.
is that, generally speaking, your comment with respect to a lot of the problems that the post-polios get into with a very tight standard error?
No, I wouldn't say with aging. I would say with a fixed interval out from polio.
That's what I meant. Excuse me.
That's a really critical point.
And
you got to look at it in terms of years at risk of exposure to developing a problem.
Let's take the
difficulty in, let me just finish. The difficulty of looking at a group like this, any group like this, is it's sort of a life table problem. You know, everyone sort of got the problem at a different age.
Let me just comment, though, and I think that in this slide, the second panel down where it says weakness previously unaffected muscles, and the one just above that, it says weakness previously affected muscles, and it appears that the standard error is fairly tight. Am I?
Yes.
Well, I think you have to be very cautious about standard errors, because standard errors mask the fact that your spread is much larger than what appears with standard errors. For instance, your N is 25. In order to get the standard deviation, you take the square root of...
No. The N of the red group is 176.
176?
Yes.
Well, let's say it's... If it's 176, that would make your standard error your standard deviation gigantic. You see, your standard error is posited on the fact that you take the... or your standard deviation is determined by taking the square root of your N and dividing it by the standard and multiplying it by the standard error, so that I wonder whether or not your spread is as small as it appears on the screen. What did you say your standard N was for your first value there?
Well, for the group, the red group, the hospitalized group, it's 176.
And 176, let's say it's 100. Square root of 100 would be 10. 10 times 2 would be 20. So your standard deviation would be 34 plus minus 20 rather than 34 plus minus 2. I think, unless I'm misinterpreting it, it appears that when you report the standard error, it looks like you have a much tighter band on both sides of your mean than in fact you do. And I'm wondering whether or not individuals in the room found that the complaints began to occur much sooner than what you would indicate by your report here. In other words, do your complaints begin, let's say, 5 years after the onset of having polio, or 10 years? From your figures up here, it would appear that they could begin very soon after they've had polio, or very late after they've had polio, but not with that very small standard error that you report, unless I'm misinterpreting your standard error. Standard errors I always find extremely difficult, because what they do is they truncate your spread. Mm-hmm. Does anybody in the room know whether or not any of their polio patients develop weakness much sooner than 30 years after the onset of having had the polio?
One of the real problems is the recall artifact of a recent survey. So where we do have some linked clinical data, the recall of it that tends to be precipitated by or around the 3 to 4 year time interval when our surveys were done, where our clinical records indicate in some cases onset of weakness where we've got the full 30-year record at an earlier date than was reported. So I think there's a separate methodological question of the recall of when weakness occurred and what we get retrospectively at looking, asking them now in the midst of the debate over post-polio, particularly among groups of people that are self-identified.
I think the reason for bringing that up is that it's extremely important, because this would indicate, as you mentioned before, that this looks like a late onset development of signs and symptoms. Well, in point of fact, these signs and symptoms may well occur very soon after an individual had polio, and as a youngster, they may well just ignore them, or they just forget about them, you see, which would therefore then exclude something like a late virus phenomena, or let's say an aging phenomena. It may well be simply due to a different phenomena altogether. So I don't think that we would want to become pigeonholed into thinking that all of these symptoms necessarily occur 30 years after the onset that they've had polio, you see.
Thank you for the comment. Just one thing, and then I think we're going to have to do break to stay on time. You were sort of using standard error and standard deviation interchangeably, and they're not the same idea. They represent a similar concept, but the standard deviation really refers to a distribution. Standard error refers to an ideal or a hypothetical distributions of which we're talking about the standard error of the medians. So there is a difference.
Of the 193 patients we looked at over the last 5 years, there is a group that are coming back for care with pain or weakness after 10 years. There's a larger group after 20, but the largest group is after 30.
Jacqueline Perry of Rancho Los Amigos.
We are going to break for coffee for 20 minutes. Please be back at 11:15. Thank you. Should not take his seat, however. To introduce Dr. Frederick Maynard from the University of Minnesota. Not the University of Minnesota at all. The University of Michigan.
Sorry, I didn't give the name of your speaker. Oh, that's okay, thanks. Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and I'd really like to thank Dr. Weekers and Dr. Halstead for engineering this conference. My talk is entitled Differential Diagnosis of Pain and Weakness in Post-Polios. Increasing weakness and pain, as we've been hearing about, are really frequent problems for patients with residual neuromuscular dysfunctions from previous polio. A recent questionnaire that Dr. Ann Bailey presented a few years ago, goes along with what Dr. Halstead just finished, and it showed that about 70% of their patients were reporting pain, and about 84% were reporting change in muscle strength and endurance. There are many potential etiologies, of course, for these problems, particularly in view of the wide variety of residual muscle imbalances, orthopedic deformities, and compensatory functional adaptations seen in these patients. One possible etiology is the so-called post-polio syndrome of progressive muscular atrophy and weakness from further amyotrophy of muscles previously involved by polio. I use the term amyotrophy to mean a loss of functioning anterior horn cells resulting in muscle atrophy and weakness. Slowly progressive amyotrophy resulting in gradual decrease in maximum strength and or endurance of muscles previously involved by polio can be expected to produce pain complaints by causing overuse strain on functionally useful muscles, tendons, ligaments, and joints, producing a wide variety of musculoskeletal pain and motion problems. Increasing weakness can also be expected to result in a variety of problems in carrying out daily activities of mobility, self-care, work, and recreation. In order to explore these ideas and learn more about the post-polio syndrome, a post-polio clinic was established by the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at the University of Michigan Medical Center about 2 years ago. The clinical approach to evaluation of these patients had three major components. First, a careful history was taken to determine specific changes in neuromuscular function and strength in relation to the patient's lifestyle adaptations from any residual neuromuscular impairments or orthopedic deformities resulting from previous polio. The specific relationship of exercise, exertion, and repetitive use of muscles to complaints of pain, weakness, or fatigue was established by the careful review of their activity pattern. Secondly, a careful biomechanical evaluation of the presenting problem in view of the current muscle strength, joint range of motion, or joint deformities was made. Thirdly, electrodiagnostic studies were carried out whenever indicated and permitted by the patient. If I could have the first slide. Now, before I started, I needed to establish some criteria for what I would use for a diagnosis of the post-polio syndrome, and I throw those up for your critical review. This is what I will be using. Number one, a history of decline in maximal strength of muscles previously involved by polio that is not explained by another diagnosis, and or a clear history of transient muscle fatigue, weakness, or myalgia following exercise or prolonged use of involved muscles. And secondly, electrodiagnostic evidence of motor unit abnormalities in the symptomatic muscles. Next slide. During a two-year, David, could you, or do I have this up here? Thank you. During a two-year period, 30 patients were evaluated in the above manner at the post-polio clinic. 18 patients met the above criteria for a diagnosis of post-polio syndrome. The population included 25 women and 5 men. The average age at the time of the clinic evaluation for the patients diagnosed as having the post-polio syndrome was 50 years, with a range of 34 to 65 years. Their average age of having acute poliomyelitis was 13 years, range 2 to 31 years. And the average interval from acute polio to onset of post-polio syndrome symptoms was 31 years, or a range of 20 to 53 years. And I think that's very fascinating that that fits right in with what Dr. Halstead just reported to us. The patients, I thought it was also interesting that if you compare that now with the 12 patients who I did not make a diagnosis of post-polio syndrome, but who presented in the clinic, interestingly, they had a younger age of onset at time of polio, being, again, 8 years with a range of 1 to 16 years. The patients actually averaged 6 years from the onset of their post-polio syndrome symptoms, however, to being seen in the clinic. Now, among the 12 post-polio patients who were not diagnosed as post-polio syndrome, their average age, again, was about the same when seen, or 49 years, with a wider range of from 31 up to 80 years. And their average age of acute polio was less. 15 of the 18 patients, or 83%, with the post-polio syndrome had been ambulatory following recovery from acute polio. 7 of the 12 patients, or only 58%, not having the post-polio syndrome were ambulatory. That would have been at the time of their maximal recovery from acute polio. This difference between the two groups suggests the ambulatory patients may more frequently develop progressive muscular atrophy, perhaps from chronic overuse of weakened muscles. It may also be that ambulatory patients are more aware of modest decreases in strength and more readily seek clinic evaluation. The onset of post-polio syndrome symptoms was slow in 15 of the 18 patients, but 3 patients did report a sudden onset of symptoms, and I mean sudden over a period of days to weeks as opposed to many months to years. One of these that reported a rather sudden onset did have it follow trauma. Next slide, please, Dave. The chief complaint among the 18 patients diagnosed as having the post-polio syndrome, that was their chief complaint that brought them into the clinic, was decreasing strength in 9, pain of some sort, musculoskeletal pain in 8, and one patient who was complaining of more trouble breathing. Next slide. The post-exercise, some of the symptoms or major symptoms among the 18 patients with the post-polio syndrome included prominent post-exercise fatigue and transient decreases of strength in 9 patients. And when I talk about the, 8 patients rather. When I talk about transient post-exercise weakness, I'm specifically talking about a patient who reports that when they start out doing a repetitive activity, such as walking or repetitive arm use, that after doing that for a period of time, they find that they no longer can do it, so that it looks like a post-exercise weakness with resolution of that after rest. Post-exercise myalgia, and what I mean by this is, again, an aching pain in the muscle unit or the muscle belly, was reported as a prominent symptom in 5 of the 18. 4 patients reported the onset of their symptoms following several months of participation in aerobic or other conditioning exercise programs, similar to, I think, the case that Dr. Weekers described. Fasciculations were a prominent symptom or observed finding in actually only 3 of these patients, and was also a prominent complaint in 1 patient who was not diagnosed as having the post-polio syndrome. You can put the slides off now and put the lights on if you like. The chief complaint among the 12 patients not diagnosed as having postprandial syndrome included musculoskeletal pain in 6, equipment problems in 3, breathing problems in 1, and progressive orthopedic deformity in 1. One patient presented with a complaint of post-exercise myalgia or more trouble walking, but was excluded from the postprandial syndrome diagnostic group because of a normal electromyogram in the symptomatic muscles. 2 of the patients with pain complaints were diagnosed as having a symptomatic carpal tunnel syndrome. 1 patient who presented with complaints of increasing difficulty breathing had a long history of restrictive lung disease as a residual from old polio, but did not have any measurable changes on pulmonary function studies, including negative inspiratory force when he was seen, and therefore was not included as a post-polio syndrome patient. He died suddenly several months after being seen, apparently from respiratory failure. Musculoskeletal pain problems consisted of back pain in 5 patients, neck pain in 6 patients, and shoulder pain in 9 patients. 6 of the 9 patients with shoulder girdle muscle complaints had a correlation between their symptoms and their use of canes or crutches for ambulation. None of the shoulder pain patients had x-ray evidence of degenerative arthritis in the glenohumeral or acromial clavicular joints. Shoulder girdle pain complaints were attributed to nonspecific overuse strain in 2, to shoulder bursitis in 2, to tendonitis and diffuse myofasciitis in a particular muscle in 3, to epicondylitis in 1, and to chronic glenohumeral subluxation in 1. Back pain was attributed to chronic muscular strain in 4 cases, 1 associated with scoliosis and 1 with pelvic asymmetry from leg length discrepancy. 1 case had the onset of chronic back pain following a fall, which resulted in a hematoma of the upper thoracic paraspinal muscles. Neck pain was attributed to cervical muscle strain and chronic tension in 2, atlantoaxial osteoarthritis in 1, and cervical spondylosis in 3. A diagnosis of cervical disc degeneration without radiculopathy by electromyogram was considered possible in 2 of the 3 cases with cervical spondylosis on the basis of clinical examination in response to cervical traction. 6 of the 18 patients who underwent electrodiagnostic examination had slowed conduction of the median nerve at the wrist. However, only 2 of these patients had significant symptoms related to the carpal tunnel syndrome. 4 of these 6 patients were ambulators using upper extremity aids. The 2 symptomatic patients had some response to custom modifications of their crutch or cane handles. 3 patients had degenerative arthritis of the thumb or index finger joints, and all were ambulators using upper extremity aids. 19 of the 30 patients were told to alter their activity to decrease strain and or excessive exertion of their involved muscles. 9 patients were specifically advised to do this in order to minimize any potential harmful effect from overuse on the amyotrophy process. In 10 patients, a change of activity level was advised in order to manage their musculoskeletal pain complaints. Alterations in mobility which were advised included the new use of a cane or crutch in 3, new use of a brace or an altered brace in 3, discontinuation of any limited ambulation in 2, new use of a wheelchair that had never been used by the patient since his acute polio in 1, and the new use of electric wheelchairs in 6. It was partial intermittent use of electric wheelchairs. This experience actually of increased need for mobility aids is similar to that reported by Anderson et al. In Lancet in 1972. Electrodiagnostic evaluations were carried out in 15 of the 18 patients who were diagnosed as having the post-polio syndrome. All 15 showed motor unit changes consistent with a chronic neuropathic process, which included increased amplitude and duration of motor unit action potential, increase in percentage of polyphasic motor units, and decrease in number of motor units on maximum recruitment. 4 patients showed some spontaneous activity, positive waves or fibrillations, in some of the symptomatic muscles. That's only 2 out of 15. 2 patients had prominent fasciculations on electromyogram. A single fiber study on 1 patient showed a normal jitter and an increase in fiber density suggesting chronic but not acute denervation. 1 patient had had a muscle biopsy performed at the Mayo Clinic, which was interpreted as showing nonspecific changes in neurogenic atrophy. Repetitive stimulation studies were done on 3 patients and were normal. These findings are similar to those reported by Hayward and Seaton, who studied 24 asymptomatic old polios that weren't complaining of any new symptoms. They also found motor unit changes of chronic denervation in all muscles previously involved by polio, and only a few patients with fasciculations or spontaneous activities. It was concluded from review of the above-described clinical experience that the post-polio syndrome frequently causes problems for patients by bringing on musculoskeletal pain syndromes, as well as by producing decreases in strength which alter functional abilities. Treatment of musculoskeletal pain syndromes is complicated by further disuse atrophy associated with resting muscle to allow healing of inflammation in the contractile musculotendinous units. Many of the chronically painful muscles were very thick and fibrotic on palpation. And three patients reported episodes of painful soft tissue or what sounded like muscle swelling following exertion. I did not observe any of the patients at the time they were reporting that. In addition, efforts to promote some improvement in strength by gradual and controlled strengthening programs after improvement of pain by rest often caused recurrence of the pain problems. The clinical experience with these patients also indicated a poor response to attempts at strengthening involved muscles or improving their endurance through any type of exercise program, even if pain was not a major problem. Strengthening exercises often made pain and increasing weakness worse. Therefore, my approach has been to recommend maintaining strength only by continuing important and meaningful functional activities, such as independent self-care, ambulation, work, or recreational activities, whenever possible and not necessary as part of the treatment of a pain complaint. Two brief case reports I'd like to review to illustrate these clinical problems in post-polios. Case one was a 64-year-old professor of economics at the University of Michigan who had had a history of acute polio in 1950 at age 31. He had residual lower extremity weakness, particularly the quadriceps muscles, worse on the left side. Following initial rehabilitation efforts, he became ambulatory without upper extremity aids by 1952, or 2 years later. About 25 to 30 years later, in the middle 70s, he again began using a cane on the right side because of increasing weakness in his legs when walking long distances. In August 1980, he was first evaluated for increasing leg weakness, particularly in the right knee extensors, which he had felt had changed where he had been aware more of weakness in his left. Examination at that time showed quadriceps strength of 4-5 on the right and 4/5 on the left. Maximal isometric torque produced by the quadriceps as measured by the Cybex apparatus with the knee at 90 degrees of flexion showed 8.5 foot-pounds on the left and 21 foot-pounds on the right. Electrodiagnostic examination of the left quadriceps showed 2+ small fibrillations in positive waves, very large amplitude motor unit action potentials, which were mostly polyphasic, and a very decreased maximal interference pattern. Similar but less abnormal motor unit changes were present in the left gluteus medius and anterior tibialis. He was advised to perform gentle quadriceps strengthening exercises using 1¾-pound ankle weights on the right and 2¼ pounds on the left. In December of 1980, he fell and fractured his left foot. He recovered from that, but of course had discontinued exercises, and was next evaluated in August of 1981, and at that time his strength had not really changed from what it had been in about a year before. However, 2 years later, in July of 83, he again noted increasing leg weakness and more difficulty climbing stairs and was really having trouble standing up from a chair. Quadriceps strength at that time was graded 2+/-5 bilaterally. He had difficulty completing a full range of motion, particularly more than one or two times. Strengthening exercises were again recommended using a 1/4-pound weight. And over the next few months, he actually increased the weights up to 1 pound. He was doing them about 10 repetitions a day. This was actually, I wasn't taking care of him at the time. And then he sort of discontinued the exercises on his own. When he was next evaluated in December of 83 by myself in the post-polio clinic, at that time he was complaining of slight further loss of strength. And now he was really, or I don't know if he was really complaining of it or I brought it out, but there was a definite history of post-exercise transient decrease of strength. He said at that point in time he was still walking approximately a half mile, and by the end of the half mile he was he had difficulty stabilizing his knees so that if he didn't rest he would fall. At that time, his knee, manual muscle testing again continued to grade his knee extensors 2 plus over 5 with an inability to really fully extend the knee against gravity. He could get it against gravity if you sort of let him recline and sort of cheat, at least on the left side. The patient was advised at that time to discontinue quadricep exercises and to avoid exertion to the point of greater weakness. A few weeks, last week actually, in May of this year, repeat measurements were done on the Cybex to get a comparison, and using the same technique, 90 degrees of knee flexion with an isometric hold, showed now 7 pounds on the left, which compared to the 8.5 that had been done 4 years before, and 8 foot-pounds on the right, which compared to the 21 foot-pounds that he had gotten 4 years earlier on the right. Surface electromyographic recordings of the quadriceps during maximum isometric contraction showed no obvious change in amplitude of the recorded EMG signal during 30 to 40 seconds before fatigue and decline to the half of his maximum force. And what I was doing in that, I can stop for a minute to describe it, was sort of a clinical experience to see if I could learn anything, which I guess I wasn't clear what we did. But a colleague of mine at the University of Michigan has recently been investigating the use of a technique called acoustic myography, which is a matter of listening to the sounds produced by contracting muscles. And one of the useful uses that they've been doing with this technique has been to do combined acoustic myography recordings along with surface EMG recordings during a maximum isometric hold of a major strain, so that if you took a biceps muscle, which is mostly what they had taken on normal people, and pull with a strain gauge, you can see over a period of about a minute and a half or 2 minutes that the maximum force you can hold will fall off into the point where you can't stand it anymore, which is probably your lactic acid buildup from discomfort in the muscle, and of course you let go. Well, during that period of time, the EMG signal in general looks the same at the end of the time as it does in the beginning, as I think most of us would expect. Interestingly, the acoustic signal has a decline in its amplitude of the acoustic signal that roughly correlates with the decline in force that the strain gauge is measuring. So we did this on this gentleman's quadriceps muscles that were in this 2-plus kind of range of strength. And interestingly, what we found was that there was, again, no change in his electromyographic interference pattern over that period. It was a very shortened fatigue. We think it's shortened. We don't really have normal controls totally. But his maximum force output was, of course, very decreased, but he held it for about 40 seconds. Interestingly, the acoustic signal that was recorded during that same period of fatigue did not decline in a fashion corresponding with the decrease on the strain gauge, such as had been observed in normals when they were giving their maximum output. There was about a 10% decline in the acoustic signal. And that really puzzled us. It was not what we expected. But we think that that's really explained by the fact that, again, it's a matter of we don't understand enough, I guess, about the acoustic myography, but it appears that the acoustic signal is only linear with the force decline during the middle and upper ranges of strength output, so that if you really are putting out a very minimal contraction in normal muscle, in fact, the signal does not correlate in that linear fashion. So we suspect that it was a matter of he had such a low force output that there was not much of a decline, which probably relates to whatever it is that you're truly listening to at that time. We can talk more about that later if you'd like. Anyway, the patient reported no greater weakness at this time than he had in about last December, and he was advised, I've been advising him to, if he wants to continue long distance walking for whatever purpose, that he ought to begin using two canes to further protect himself. Next case I'd like to talk about briefly, it was a 37-year-old woman, a married housewife, with a history of polio at age 5, which left her with mild residual weakness of her left arm and leg. She had underwent surgery on the left ankle at age 9 and was aware of mild shortening of the left leg, but otherwise was really not aware of residual problems from polio. She presented at the post-polio clinic in June of 83, complaining of generalized fatigue and weakness. Further history revealed that she had developed a right tennis elbow after taking up tennis 5 years previously and had had surgery for this. A year previously, she had begun an aerobic exercise class, but became very fatigued and wiped out after the class and really couldn't continue to participate. And over the past few months, she had been noticing the onset of pain on both sides of her neck with spread into her upper arms. And she noticed greater fatigue and weakness in her right arm, in particular after prolonged use of it. Now, an activity history revealed that she was not only a busy homemaker with three children and doing most of the home management, but also worked full-time at a college for the deaf, doing signing with her upper extremities for about 20 hours a week. Physical examination showed a mild scoliosis, a positive left Trendelenburg test, and about 1.5 inch of shortening of the left leg. Neck examination, range of motion, Sperling test, etc., was normal. Neurologic examination was remarkable only for 4/5 strength in the right triceps, pronator teres, and opponent's pollicis. CBC and cervical spine x-rays were normal. Electromyogram showed widespread motor unit changes consistent with previous polio in her upper and lower extremities. She was advised to avoid prolonged activities which produced undue fatigue or prolonged pain. She received supportive counseling for depression about her declining strength and reduced activities. 4 months later, she returned and reported a marked increase in pain in her shoulders and neck that became much worse after doing her work as a signer, as well as if she was doing housework and particular things which involved elevation of her arms. Careful manual muscle testing, with the help of one of my physical therapists, I will admit, showed 3/5 weakness in her right serratus anterior and 4/5 weakness of all the scapular stabilizers, including the trapezius bilaterally. There was a painful arc on shoulder elevation and localized pain on palpation of very thickened supraspinatus tendon. She was advised to discontinue any signing, at least it gave her a temporary work restriction, and or medical leave, and otherwise avoids any strenuous use of her arm. She was begun on anti-inflammatory medications and physical therapy treatments with local heat and ultrasound. Over the following 6 months, she required very careful activity monitoring, continued frequent physical therapy treatments, and supportive counseling. She terminated her employment, became convinced that it was not going to be possible for her to continue to work 20 hours a week, which is what her employer insisted on that she be able to do if she was continued to employ by them, doing signing, and was did not feel there was any way to really do that job of deaf-mute signing with some type of an apparatus for shoulder support. Her symptoms continued to fluctuate in intensity in relationship to how much she tried to do. After 3 months of, during that 6 month interval, after about 3 months of watching this come and go and seeing her fall apart, we put her on virtually a complete activity restriction. So she was really limited to being at home and really not doing any of her housework, just doing her self-care. And if she did any writing or anything else with her upper extremities, she did it on a table where she could rest her elbows. She continued in frequent physical therapy treatments, and finally, after that period of 3 months, is asymptomatic, finally free of her severe pains, and beginning to tolerate minimal exercises and light activities with her arm again. Now, although none of the 30 post-polio patients in this group had a history of rapid loss of muscle strength that might suggest a diagnosis of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis or other motor neuron diseases, I have seen such patients at other times, and I suspect many of you in the room have. There's a lot of reports in the medical literature that I think we've already referred to earlier today that have discussed the relationship between motor neuron diseases and the past history of polio. The clinical course of the patients described in this report is more compatible, I believe, with the theory that post-polio progressive muscular atrophy is a result of age-related losses of anterior horn cells, which results in symptoms because of the already reduced numbers of anterior horn cells. The experience also supports the notion that chronic use of weakened muscles at or maximum loads may speed up these age-related changes, and I think it also is suggestive of what Dr. Halstead was I guess, concluding from his survey that there may well be a time period after polio in which this phenomena begins. Certainly many of the patients in this series, I think, were too young to expect significant age-related losses of anterior horn cells as the sole explanation for their troubles. And most of the muscles with the progressive weakness were being regularly used at the maximum loads for their normal daily activities. Now, since there are no specific or objective clinical or laboratory findings for the post-polio syndrome yet identified, other diseases of the motor unit obviously need to be excluded. And I think a history of rapid loss of muscle strength particularly demands consideration of other possible etiologies for motor neuron diseases. A diagnosis of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, which is the one I think that's been entertained most frequently in the literature, from my simplistic perspective anyway, I think can usually be ruled out on the basis of clinical examination for upper motor neuron or bulbar signs. And again, you expect a time course of more rapidly progressive symptoms over weeks to months. The electrodiagnostic abnormalities of widespread and prominent spontaneous activity and fasciculation are expected with ALS, but of course are not always seen. Nerve conduction studies, on the other hand, can rule out the potential associated problem of generalized peripheral neuropathies or entrapment neuropathies. Electromyographic studies can also confirm presence of a radiculopathy from disc degeneration or from other causes. I think we had a nice illustration of that in one of Dr. Weaker's cases. Radiographic examinations and other studies can rule out any suspicion in a particular patient of carcinoma, which again at times can be associated with amyotrophy. Toxic metal screening tests can be done if there's a suspicion of toxin exposure leading to motor neuron diseases. And I think that's about as far as the list of really differential diagnoses that I'm aware of. And again, I would say that I think the most intriguing possibility is really the one that, to me anyway, is the one that Dr. Johnson raised as to whether there is perhaps a more widespread phenomena going on in the spinal cord in these patients that is not just exclusively limited to the anterior horn cells, as we have, I guess, previously thought, but maybe is part of a continuum of some other sort. So I'll stop with that and entertain questions.
And Fred, if you'll repeat the question as best you can when the...
We're going to use the microphone.
Yeah. I'd like to bring up one question first, take the moderator's prerogative.
This is the end of tape 2. Questions and answers follow on tape 2B.